practical is absolutely right.
This this paper is about taking a theoretical verifiable voting system and trying to apply it in practice in a context where the election rules are complex, not to say awkward. You'll see there's a whole number of people involved on the paper. There are other people like Douglas who have been involved in some of this work who aren't listed as well. The idea is to provide something that the State of Victoria in Australia can use for their state elections. So where I'm going to start is with a little bit about how voting works in Victoria. Then something about the existing e-voting that happens in Victoria. Then we'll look at Pressavote, which I suspect most of you will be reasonably familiar with already, as the verifiable system that will form the backbone of the implementation. And then I'll talk a little bit about the challenges in adapting PRET to fit in with the VEC system, which I suspect was not what Peter Ryan had primarily in mind when he came up with his idea for PRET. Okay, so here's how voting works in Victoria. I'm conscious that there are a couple of people here who know more than I do about this, so please do correct me if I get this wrong. There are it's a bicameral system, so there are two houses. There's a lower house and an upper house. The lower house is more complex than you will be used to if you're from the States, but considerably less complex than for the upper house. So there's a flat list of candidates. Five would be fairly typical. It wouldn't go above 10. And what you have to do is number them in order. So you have to give a full preference ranking of the candidates. So this is by IRV, the details of which aren't critical, instant runoff voting, where you have to give a full preference ranking. So you can't just choose one for the one you like most and then stop. You have to give a full ranking. So that's the lower house. The upper house is orders of magnitude more complicated. This is a ballot paper. You'll see that there's a thick line going across the centre. What you have across the top is one box for each party. And what you can do if you want is you can just choose a single one of the boxes representing one of the parties. That's called voting above the line. The semantics of that when it comes to the tallying, I'll tell you in a second. Below the line, what you have is the complete list of all of the candidates who are standing in the election. If you want to vote below the line, you can do, and you're required then to give a full ranking of all of these candidates, which is of the order of 40 to 50, maybe. Again, you can't just... you can in this election. You can number at least five choices and then stop if you want to. In some elections below the line, you have to give a full ranking. In this one, you can just give five preferences. That's because there are five seats. So what will happen in this election is multi-member STV, single transferable votes, where five winners will emerge from the election. And for that reason, though this is, it's not strictly necessary, but for that reason, you have to give at least five preferences. Now, if you vote above the line, the semantics of that are that if I vote for party two here and then fill in nothing anywhere else, what I'm doing is I'm saying I'm effectively proxying my vote to party two. Party two will have published a complete ranking of all of the candidates in advance of the election. And by ticking the party two box, I'm saying I would like to go with party two's complete and published ranking. This is the first time I've booted into Windows for about 10 years. Um, There's a slight extra wrinkle, which is that Party 2 can, if it wants to, publish more than one complete ranking. And then what will happen at the end is that all of the ballots will be counted and will be all of the Party 2 above the line votes will be allocated uniformly to those different lists that have been published by that party. So they effectively get turned into below the line votes before they get tabulated. The state of Victoria has been using some form of electronic voting since 2006, which is quite early. Not many places have been using electronic voting that early, but the VEC, the Victorian Electoral Commission, has been doing so. And that's for a number of reasons. So one of them is the flexibility that it gives you. So the rules of the election say that you are allowed to vote in your home district or in your state and out of that district, or even in another state or in various places overseas. And that's awkward when it comes to voting on paper, because it means that all of these locations have to have ballot papers for all of the different districts, or else you have to have some kind of print-on-demand set up to deal with that. We'll come back to that later, because that will be important for what we're looking at implementing. For dealing with that, it's helpful to have some sort of electronic voting system where you're voting at a terminal that can display whatever kind of ballot paper you need. Accessibility was also an important consideration. It's easier to support disabled voters, blind voters, voters who don't speak English and so on, if you use electronic voting. That is particularly true if you've got a complex election system. If all you've got to do is put one cross in one box, then it's not too bad. But if you've got to fill in a ranking of 40 candidates, then that's quite a serious issue. Now, Australia has compulsory voting, but although voting is compulsory, there are quite a number of people who end up accidentally casting an invalid vote because the rules are complex enough that not everybody understands what they're doing. So you might end up with somebody who puts the parties in a ranking order, or doesn't fill in as many choices as they're required to below the line, or puts two ones below the line or something like that. As well as dealing with disabled voters and so on, this also helps with usability for able-bodied voters, because it reduces the number of spoilt votes, informal ballots as they're called in Australia, where somebody's intended to cast a valid vote and has screwed up because it was too complicated. Obviously, if you have an electronic system, then it's easier for the system to tell you that you've done something wrong and send you back to have another go. Now, that's the system that has been used so far, but there are some weaknesses of it. You can't go and look at it, you can't go and mess about with it. It doesn't provide you with any verifiability. For those reasons, the VEC has been looking at ways to improve that and ways to come up with a verifiable system that can be used in Victoria to improve some of these issues. So what we're looking at is finding a way of getting electronic voting into Victoria, but having a much stronger verifiability than is currently there. So that's what we've been looking at. It's a difficult issue because it's, as far as I'm aware, in fact, I'm sure this is true, this is the most complex election that anybody's tried to do on a large scale with verifiable voting. Handling the STV, handling the preferential side of things is tricky with a large scale election. Pressivote looks like being the best option, and so it becomes a question of adapting that to deal with the practical issues. So there are various issues that we needed to resolve before we could make too much progress. So this usability versus security is a perennial issue, but in a complex election that becomes even more of a problem because the usability is quite low to start with, even when you're just dealing with a piece of paper. So how you get your security in without substantially reducing usability in a system that's already quite unusable is a problem. Scalability becomes more of an issue as well when you're dealing with crypto voting because you're not encrypting just a few bits of information per voter. You're encrypting a lot more, and with that comes a large amount of data that needs to be transferred around, as you'll see later. There are some practical issues. It's much easier if you're filling in a piece of paper and then scanning it in. It's much easier to deal with the cross and the box. It's very easy to know where the cross is if there's only one cross. Doing OCR for handwritten digits, for instance, is much trickier. I'll give you a very, very quick introduction to PrettaVoto, but we won't have time to go through it in detail, and I'm sure most of you have seen it before. This is Peter Ryan's baby. It's a verifiable system where you vote on paper and then part of your bit of paper is scanned in to a system that doesn't learn the content of your vote. Every stage of it is verifiable in different ways. And so what you get out of it at the end is evidence, a proof that the election result is as it should have been. The privacy issues are dealt with by various mechanisms that we'll come back to later. But essentially, the trust that you have to place in machines for privacy is distributed in PrettaVoto, so that you're not trusting a single machine for not leaking your vote, and even that trust shouldn't allow integrity of the election to be compromised. So this is how you vote. We have a candidate list down the left-hand side and voting boxes down the right-hand side, and some encrypted information on the right-hand side that encodes the candidate order. When I vote, I fill in the right-hand side, whether it's preferential or an X in the box, I fill in the right-hand side. The left-hand side is then removed and shredded. And what I'm left with is a ranking that no one can interpret unless they know what the order of the names was on the left-hand side. And because that's randomized separately per ballot paper, this doesn't reveal anything about my vote because you don't know what candidate name was written here. I take that home with me having scanned it in, and that then becomes my receipt that I can check on a bulletin board of all receipts later on. So I can type this number in and I can check that my vote appears on the web bulletin board unaltered. When it comes to tallying the votes later, well, each of these now needs decrypting so it can be interpreted, but that's done by passing the votes through a mixnet. I won't go into the details of a mixnet here, but they'll be decrypted so that they're mixed up as they're decrypted, so that nobody learns the link between the receipts and the decrypted votes, but everybody can see that the two sides as a whole match up. So they're mixed, they're then decrypted. The decrypted votes are published, and then anyone can check the tally by simply adding them up. So this is a rough schematic of a mixed net. You'll see that what happens over here is I've got some votes. They get shuffled up, but what I end up with on the right-hand side is the same votes in a different order, and then they're decrypted and tallied. And a proof is given at each stage that they really were mixed as they should have been. So the verifiability comes from, in the first stage, by voters checking their receipts on the web bulletin board. That's how I know that the encrypted votes corresponded to what the voters intended to cast. The second stage, the MixNet, that's verified by checking the proofs that the MixNet gives. So I now know that the shuffled votes correspond to the unshuffled votes. And then anyone can publicly check the decryption and the tallying and the results of the election that come out of the far end by information that's made public at that stage. How you go about implementing that in Victoria? Well, there are various problems. So you're dealing with a lot of candidates. For voting below the line, you've got 35 plus candidates. Now, in PRET, they need to be in a random order. That gives you some severe usability issues. What they're supposed to do on your Victorian ballot paper is appear in party order. But now we've got all the parties jumbled up and we've got a long list of candidates. Finding the candidate that you want to vote for, especially when you're trying to do a full ranking, becomes a serious headache. So you'd end up with a very, very long ballot paper that would be very hard to interpret and fill in. We've also got a lot of crypto to handle now, because in creating each ballot paper for the below-the-line votes, I'm going to need one encryption per candidate. So I've got an awful amount of cryptography to create before I start. This is what we've chosen to go with. There seems to be no way round abandoning the principle that the device that you vote with doesn't know how you vote. That has, I think, become increasingly clear over the last few years, that if you've got a very simple type of election, then you can maintain the principle that no machine ever finds out how you voted. If you've got a complex structure, then in order for it to be usable for you to fill in your ballot paper, it's impossible to maintain the principle that the machine into which you feed your vote doesn't know how you voted. So we've had to move away from that. What we've come up with is a ballot paper where this is like a normal Pressavoté ballot paper, but flipped round. So the candidate list appears on the right. And there are QR codes that the machine can scan in, and it can use that to work out what the candidate order list was, and it can then display on the screen. So this is what a ballot paper looks like with all of the candidates just displayed in a flat random list. This is the back side, so this is below the line. This is the top side, so this is above the line and Legislative Assembly. And what the machine does is to help you fill this in. So it scans in the QR code and it then gets you to fill things in on the screen. And it will then overprint the ballot paper with the preference ranking that you gave the machine. So that what it's doing is it's filling in a Pressavoté ballot paper for you, and your job then is to check when you've done that what it gave you corresponds to what you filled in. It then gets submitted in the normal way, because this is now just a Pressavoté ballot paper, and you can check later on that it corresponds to what was in the system. It then goes through a MixNet, as I've said, Verificatum, Douglas's Verificatum is the MixNet that it goes through. This is quite a challenge because there's so much information going through it. There are so many ciphertexts going through it. But we've got it down to a reasonable running time with some hope of reducing that further with more optimizations. One last thing I should alert you to. We've now moved towards print on demand simply because of that issue of needing to distribute the ballot papers in advance, and that's impossible if anybody can vote anywhere. So we're now moving towards print on demand, where we distribute the process. So a number of servers are involved in creating print-on-demand encrypted ballots that nobody can interpret except a threshold set of these print-on-demand servers. And they, at vote time, will then, the printer will send a blinding factor. That will get applied. They will do a threshold decryption and send back the blinded, decrypted ballot paper. That will get unblinded by the printer and then printed out. There's then an auditing step that can be used to challenge the printing if the voter wants to do that. And when you're happy that you've got a correct ballot, you then go ahead and print. I've skipped out various of the various steps because of time, but do come and ask me or any of the others involved if you want to know some more of the details. I should just flag up one last thing, which is that this process of having a machine that prints something out and then you scan in the result, that is something that we're now looking at dropping. That was quite important initially because we wanted to make sure that there was no machine that was online that could learn how you voted, and that was an offline machine that was helping you fill it out. Now that we've got the print on demand, that's less of an issue because the printer is already online and knows the content of the ballot paper. So we're now looking at getting rid of that step so that the machine that you feed your vote into will submit it directly and then give you something that you can verify later. I'll stop before I get tackled.
On this time. Good enough. So, James, I apologize in advance, but I'm a little confused. As if you've gone to the trouble of a ballot marking device, why bother with pre-vote? It seems like there's an additional layer of complexity that's no longer necessary. The value of pre-vote is the paper that is already pre-checked to some extent. It doesn't seem necessary anymore.
I don't understand what you're suggesting as the alternative. The ballot marking device would then just give you something that you'd put in a ballot box?
Pretty much that has, also, captures the encrypted vote in a similar way. But you don't need the pre-vote step because that's got to do with the presentation to the voter. You need to capture the encrypted vote somehow.
Right,
but
yeah.
You don't need to use the pre-vote interface anymore.
If by the pre-vote bit, you mean the randomized flat list?
Yeah.
Yeah, so the original intention there was to keep that because we didn't want to have a machine that was online that knew your vote. So we had a machine that you could use to help you fill in the pre-vote ballot paper, and that was offline. And then what you fed it into was a machine that was online that would submit it.
Doesn't seem necessary even for that.
Take that up with Vanessa.
Yeah, I guess we
we have dropped that bit now, so that you're now using a machine that submits it. But what you're getting out of the back end is the verifiability step of having your encrypted vote that you can then later challenge. So we've kind of skipped the first step of prep, you like.
We'll talk.
Question, if nobody else is going to volunteer. Have you done any usability testing to compare how well voters do with your scheme versus the existing scheme, and what are even the factors one would measure?
Right, so it should be that the voter experience is not vastly different now that step that we were just talking about has gone. So the voter experience of filling in the touchscreen or whatever to cast the vote should be the same. You have an additional step of taking your bit of paper and scanning and feeding it into the machine so that it can so that it knows what information to send off. But the filling in of the vote should be exactly the same as it was before. I mean, it'll be a redesigned and improved interface, but it doesn't need to change. What you get is an additional step when you get home of being able to verify things. I don't think there have been systematic studies on that.
Do I know here in the U.S. it's common that someone standing outside the polling place from the different political parties giving sample ballots. This is how we want you to fill out your ballot. But it seems that sample ballots would be much harder given the randomization. Have you gotten pushback from parties? Or?
Well, so that's not an issue because every voter will see the same thing when they're filling it in on screen. There won't be any randomization on the screen. But the
there's randomization if the voter wants to check the paper that gets generated.
Right. So you need to check that what comes out is corresponds to what you fed in, and there'll be a permutation. It'll be a permutation.
So it won't look like the sample ballot when it comes out of the printer.
That's right. That's right. But those How to Vote cards are much less important when you can vote above the line. So if you want to vote above the line, which is what 95% of the voters do, all you need to do is tick one party's box. So if you want to do what the party's advising you to do, you just effectively delegate your vote rather than filling in the full permutation.
But even, I'm sorry, and if someone else has a question, please jump in, but even if they're voting above the line for a party, the party order will be different when it comes out of the printer.
Right, so what you need to do is...
you actually need to read the party name and match the party name.
Right, so what will come out of the printer is something that will say party 3, and then it will have your X next to it. And you need to check that the X is next to the right party name.
And not the right position.
So you're not checking the position, you're just checking that it's in the right place, and then you're detaching and shredding the...
Yeah. Right. I think it would be very interesting to have usability studies. I'm not at all convinced that it's as simple, that it really is exactly the same. But anyway, let's give Peter a chance.
Doesn't this lead to some nasty problems on spoiled ballots? I mean, we have all kinds of problems here with overvotes and undervotes and marks that look like they're there, and a speck on the paper that gets picked up by the automatic reader as a vote when there's nothing there. It looks to me here as if this is very hard to understand what has happened on the part of the voter, and very confusing, and likely to cause some confusions. What if they only vote for 4 of the 5?
Well, then the machine will tell them you haven't finished voting
in
yet.
In real time.
Yeah,
they
absolutely.
They get immediate feedback.
Yeah.
Okay. So you're saying there are very few ways in which there can be spoiled ballots.
Yeah, that's right.
You've taken care of that.
That's right. Absolutely. So the interface can look however you like and can help you fill things
in. And there's no gap in the process somewhere that could cause something to be ruled as a spoiled ballot later on.
No.
Okay.
No. No.
That's
so,
nice.
So when there was this print and then scan step, that would have been an issue because there's the possibility of corruption in that gap. And that was why...
Okay, I see.
That was a weakness of that, and that's why it's useful that we've got rid of it. Yeah.
Let's thank James again.